The Questions Log, Week 7. No progress on 520 Kane Street since we met the monster who broke Montoya's arm. Burning right through my expenses. Hope that sci-fi super gun she picked up on the scene counts to cover her per diem for a while. I'm afraid the righteous campaign for truth and justice doesn't do much to pay the bills. Unless, that is, you happen to be Booster Gold. But how long until that house of cards comes crashing down? I may not have a nose, but sometimes I can feel it twitching. This is 52 Pickup.
Hello! Welcome to 52 Pickup, a podcast series about the greatest comic book you've never heard of. I am Gita Jackson, and I'm joined, as ever, by my co-host.
That's me, Alex Jaffe.
That's right.
Welcome to 52 Pickup.
Welcome to 52 Pickup. What a day.
What a treat to be here once again. Thanks for having me on your show, Gita.
No.
Always a delight.
Thanks for having me on your show. I love guesting on this podcast.
It feels like I live here.
I hope everyone listening to this does think of Alex Jaffe as the friend you keep in your pocket.
That's the role I was born to play.
God. So we have a real humdinger of an episode today.
We sure do.
I am so excited. I started reading it and it was so hard to not immediately start doing the podcast as I was trying to text Alex about how excited I was.
Yeah. Issue 7 is where this really picks up. It's where 52 takes off in a big way, because around this time, like the turn of the 21st century really, is when you see the rise of trade waiting culture, where rather than collecting individual issues, a lion's share of comic readers will wait for a series to be collected in a trade paperback volume, which collects multiple issues, which encompass a single story arc, and read it all one at a time rather than waiting month by month for the next installment. And typically, the range of a story arc is half a year or six issues. Now, because this is a weekly series as opposed to a monthly series, we get to the six-issue mark in a month and a half as opposed to half a year. But it remains the same that kind of marking point of knowing where a series stands and where it's going is around issue six. Like, kind of they teach you in film school that around 15 minutes into a movie, you discover the inciting incident of the movie.
Yeah.
That's what issue six is for an ongoing comic book series. And this point on is really where the comic is comfortable in exploring the concepts that it spent the last six issues putting together.
Yeah, it has given you the basic overview of who these characters are and what situations they're in. Now we're off to the races, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now the limiters are off. Greg Rucka has been chaining in an alternate dimension over a year, and now he's ready to return from hell.
Rock Lee has dropped the leg weights.
Yeah, exactly. It really, like, this stuff starts heating up. I do remember this issue also when I was reading it at the time. I remember there's specific events in this issue that altered my brain chemistry forever. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to go over this with you today, Alex. But I think first we do have to talk talent.
Oh, absolutely. We do have to talk talent. This is the first and only issue of 52 penciled and inked by Ken Lashley. Now, those first six issues of 52 were mostly brought to us by our good friend Joe Bennett, who we've spoken about to some extent. But Joe has clearly done a lot of this art in advance. And for the next five issues or so, we're going to have guest artists on each weekly issue. Some of them will come back. Some of them won't. Ken Lashley is one of the ones who's kind of a fill-in one and done here. So he's been getting professional comic artwork since 1993. He got his start during the 90s X-Men boom on Excalibur. He did a lot of fill-in work during the New 52, and currently he's back at Marvel working on their Star Wars line. So Ken Lashley's art here in places does look a little bit rushed, but it is a weekly comic series. So if there's any book that's the art is going to look rushed sometimes on, it's going to be this one. Travis Lanham, or letterer from issue 2, is back on lettering again. Now, when you look at this issue in the 52 Omnibus, you're able to get a look at some of the breakdown art that Keith Giffen did for this issue that Lashley and other artists throughout the series used as their Bible for doing their own art. When you look at that art, it seems a lot more dynamic than what ultimately ended up on the page.
Yeah, there is a lot more fluidity to the motion. It feels like they're doing storyboards for a Bruce Timm Batman series, is what it looks like. Yeah, that's exactly what it looks like, especially given the subject matter, which we will go into in a minute. But it's a very giving cartoon, whereas the art on the page is more composed, more like a fashion croquis, I would say. I don't think it necessarily affects the overall storytelling, but this is part of why running a weekly comic is really, really, really hard. Some of the vision you just impossible. Have to give up on. Yeah.
Don't do it.
Don't
if
do
you
it.
Take one lesson from this podcast, it's that this worked exactly once and never again. This is the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. And, you know, there's all these wild production stories that come out of 52 that we've told a little bit of that. But it's clear that anytime you have this many, like, superstars working on one project, I think the phrase I heard was a karmic donut. Like, everything else is consumed into the black hole that is the energy and resources that are devoted to this specific project with the huge amount of superstars on it.
Yeah.
They also did literally whatever they wanted, which screwed up a lot of people's schedules. So I feel like it was worth it, but you have to think about, like, at what cost.
Yes, it was a success that I think Morrison in particular learned a lot of incorrect lessons from.
Yeah, just shoot. And then I came out blasting. It's,
yeah.
I remember Morrison. It was like, rules not for me. Anyway, goodbye.
Yeah, but we start with a Morrison segment here, but on the whole, this is really more of kind of a Mark Wade, Greg Rucka issue, really.
Yeah. And it's, I think the two of them, this is a perfect spotlight for their particular talents. Especially Greg Rucka in this issue. Some of the best Rucka writing, like, takes me straight back into reading the really good issues of Gotham Central. Mm-hmm. But it makes me feel excited just to get that narration. Ugh. But yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah. We can start with the cover, which is straight out of a typical tabloid expose you'd see at the supermarket. Of Booster Gold kind of trying to cover up the camera as that as a big exposed appears over him.
Yeah.
That, like, he has this secret that he's hiding from the public, kind of to contrast with the Time magazine riff we saw a couple weeks ago with Lex Luthor.
Yeah. We're still pretending that comic books are just being sold on newsstands, I think, yeah. with these covers, which I think is a great conceit, because if I saw these alongside, like, next to a Newsweek, the stylistic parody is perfect, you know?
Right.
This in particular is one of my favorite covers because he does look like he's in the middle of saying a word, and it gives you the exact right tonal introduction to the problems Booster Gold is going to be experiencing very soon.
Yeah, J.G. Jones is just continually so great at capturing the spirit of what happens in this.
Yeah. As like so many other aspects of this series being like lightning in a bottle, the J.G. Jones covers are, they perfectly frame every single issue, and that feels impossible.
Yeah.
There's 52 of them.
It shouldn't work every week, and it does.
It shouldn't work every week, and yet he nails the assignment every single week. I'm in awe, frankly. Yeah,
it's wonderful. We're back on our weird nowhere planet on day one. We get our title drop, Going Down, which isn't a literary reference, but I thought I would mention that this issue came out a year after From Under the Cork Tree, Fall Out Boy's second studio album, and its lead single, Sugar,
down,
We're Going Down.
On another year round, and sugar we're going
down, swing in. Yeah, yes. the very same.
Wow.
Clearly, Fall Out Boy was on Grant Morrison's mind as they wrote this.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Honestly, I wouldn't put it past them.
Anyway, I'm gonna shut my mouth about the pop punk to comic book pipeline, but it's
real. Why would you?
Oh, it's just
what, are you saving it for another podcast?
Right. This is my time. Listen, Fall Out Boy came from a Simpsons issue. That name came from a Simpsons issue, a Simpsons episode where there is a filmic adaptation of a Fall Out Boy comic book movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were among the biggest rock bands on the planet at the same time as My Chemical Romance also was. Grant Morrison ends up becoming very good friends with Gerard Way, who is the lead singer of My Chemical Romance and also a prolific comic book writer, and his books are really, really good. And then appeared in a My Chemical Romance music video doing some acting. I don't know if Grant Morrison is an actor per se, but they were acting or trying to. That's all I'm going to say. Like, it was in the ether at the time.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's impossible. There is that connection.
I feel like pop punk and comic books are in the same milieu of culture. You know, people that care to people that wear Defend Pop Punk t-shirts are also likely to have read comic books.
Yeah, they're also really big Doom Patrol fans.
Yes.
That's where that crossover happens.
We start here with more space hero stuff. And I think although it like sort of bookends the issue, this is another example of how the space hero stuff is just so far not the most interesting plot line. The gist of these two pages is that they're freaking still stuck in space.
What's interesting to me is I think every time we have seen Starfire in this series, she is drawn completely differently.
That's so true.
And we've seen her as this like Eden-like figure. We've seen her extremely sexualized, and here she's kind of drawn as like this strung out addict, which is thematically appropriate, where we discover the space apples she's been nonchalantly munching on might actually be dulling her mind like an opposite tree of knowledge, just making her not care about the fact that she's been stuck in space for 6 weeks.
Yeah. What's interesting to me in this segment is that Animal Man says almost nothing. He is just around.
Yeah.
He is certainly here, but he has no opinions on what the proceedings.
He's like, you don't need three people for this scene. He literally says, don't bring me into it. And they don't.
But it's the Renee sequence that begins in the next page that is like the beginning of the comic book just starting up a action like a drama machine and just not stopping until the end of the issue. I'm in love with every single thing that Renee does and experiences in this issue. She's perfect. She's not perfect, but she's perfect to me. She's my beautiful child, and she's making bad decisions, but they're good decisions at the end of the day.
Doodling question marks all over her cast.
I love that. It's like the question just signed it over and over and over. So we have a 9-panel grid, very television yet again, feels very television on this first page. And then as she gets closer to like to an actual clue, it transitions from a 9-panel grid to a 6-panel grid, which I think is very interesting. The images themselves get bigger. There's more details in them. And you get a chance if you're reading, you know, and really looking at these details to sort of pick out a clue before she actually realizes it too, which I think is pretty neat. But genuinely, what makes this sequence so good is this entire monologue about Father's Day that Renee is having here.
It's interesting you bring that up because Keith Giffen, one of his major contributions to 52, and the thing that really made them keep it on track, was the idea that they would ground this in real world time by making references when they were appropriate to whatever holiday would have been happening at that time. And this is really our first holiday reference that we've gotten in the series. We'll get a lot more as time goes on. But the fact that she's mentioning Father's Day, and this is the week that Father's Day is happening in the real world, does a lot more to set that parallelism of like this being a Newsweek issue you could find on the shelf.
Yeah, and it really fits. Sometimes writers work better when they're given a box that they have to work with it. So if Rucka, I don't know if Rucka took that as a challenge or if he was like, go great, another thing I have to deal with this super wild series. But the specific mention, it really sets up the tone here for Renee. She says that her parents have disowned her. Mm-hmm. She hasn't talked to her dad in, 18 months, over a year, and she hasn't talked to her mother in twice that long.
It's all fallout from Half a Life, the award-winning Gotham Central storyline where Two-Face gets mad at her for not loving him, so he outs her as a lesbian.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal to the very heteronormative GCPD and her very Catholic parents who didn't know she was gay.
2006. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine now. I mean, in some ways, it's very easy to imagine if you are following the sort of controversy, not controversy, but the ridiculous discrimination against trans people that is happening in the United States and abroad, especially in the UK. But being just a gay person or a lesbian in 2006 was honestly extremely dangerous in some places. And like, this is an actual way to ground the comic book in politics. In the previous issue with the sort of airspace Green Lantern stuff, mm-hmm. that felt really extremely shoehorned in, right? Suddenly these people have to care about airspace issues. But Renee Montoya being a lesbian, that is a political situation and one that is really deeply felt, I think, amongst a lot of queer people from that era. So setting her up as someone who feels very familiar to us, that has these same struggles that a lot of us go through. Coming out's not easy and being outed at your job by a supervillain. I mean, I guess if you're anyone who's outing you at your job is a supervillain, in my opinion.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is like pure Raymond Chandler shit. Like, this is, she might as well be wearing a fedora and it's raining and smoking a single cigarette. She is indeed trying to light a match to smoke a cigarette on her scar, on her, her cast that's covered in question marks. It just is soaking you up in that feeling, the detective story feeling. You just end up really wanting to follow her along and root for her as she's trying to climb herself up out of the bottom of a barrel.
She makes a remark about how she's guesses the no face guy who she's been on the payroll for these past month and a half probably doesn't have much family. And that's kind of the backstory of Vic Sage, that he was dropped off as a baby at an orphanage.
Wow.
And never knew his parents. And if you're going to ask me, hey, did Vic Sage ever find who his parents were in some story arc? No, he never did. To this day, we have no idea who Vic's parents are. And that's the point. Part of why I love him.
That honestly rules.
Yeah.
I like any adoptee stories that aren't about an eternal struggle for identity that they feel bad about. And this is an internal struggle for identity that he feels good about.
Right. He, it's part of why he erases his face. He was born nobody and he's going to live as nobody.
That's perfect.
He was never adopted. He was raised in the system. Then he went to and failed out of journalism school for being too combative. And, then he got a radio show where he was fired for, again, being too iconoclastic. And then he fell into a river and died. And then he came back, and that's the question story.
We love that. You know, you're really seeing in this, even in just these two pages, how they're setting up the parallelism between the two of them.
Yeah.
Renee also doesn't have a family anymore. She's right. Also too iconoclastic for her previous job. Here, iconoclastic means being a gay alcoholic. And she also has this insatiable urge to answer questions.
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah, you've hit it exactly. And it's here that Renee discovers her first real clue that the 520 Kane Street address she's been staring at this entire series so far isn't just a winky reference to Bob Kane. There is actually a person named Kane who owns this whole street that she knows.
And it's a pretty lady.
It's a pretty lady.
And it's a pretty lady.
We haven't seen before named Kate.
If you have been paying attention to the CW's slate of television shows, you might know who this character is. But
right.
Imagine being me and being 16 years old and thinking, man, just reading like an unreal amount of homoerotic fan fiction about the, you know, members of the Bat Family. And just picking up on what this comic book is setting up for you right now. It felt pretty good.
Yeah.
It felt pretty fucking cool.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that later.
Yeah.
Don't you worry. So finally, after fumfitting around for 6 weeks, Renee has a lead, and that takes us to day three.
What I also like about these three pages, because we're going straight into day three, which is about Ralph Dibny and Booster Gold. If you notice, it goes from a nine-panel grid to a six-panel grid to a four-panel grid. Kind of like the camera is zooming in and in and in on these situations.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah, I think that's just a very cool layout trick that they've done here. Because in these panels with Booster, you go from these square panels to more rectangular ones. They're oblong, they're upright rectangles. So mm-hmm. you can see all of his body, his entire costume is in frame suddenly. And that framing does give it it goes from like prestige TV to like soap opera-y feeling.
Right. This scene is very much about exposing who Booster is as a person at this point in time, and his guest, who we're going to meet in a second. And it's just very revealing of where they are and who they are at this moment where they're converging, because that last week's Great 10 Black Adam story aside, this is really where we see two plots that have been building in 52 converging for the first time in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
The Elongated Man story and the Booster Gold story, which is appropriate because they were both kind of members of Keith Giffen and Jam DeMatteis' Justice League at the same time. So it's fitting that they're finally kind of crossing paths and checking on each other, especially when Booster had that big fallout with Fire a few issues ago.
Yeah, and you know, Ralph Dibny in this scene looks like reheated shit.
Absolutely.
He looks terrible. And the visual contrast alone really shows you the huge distance between what has happened to these characters since that JLA run. Ralph is trapped in his grief, and Booster is covered in logos and on the phone and not really paying attention to him.
Yeah, he's getting a call from Manthrax, the villain we met last week, who's asking for his money. Call drops. He's not able to get him back. Ralph is ostensibly there to ask about that weird Cult of Connor plot we saw a few weeks ago, where Cassie Sandsmark was working with these Kryptonian cultists to bring her dead boyfriend back. But he's got other things on his mind.
Yeah. He calls it the Cult of Condor, which I think is very funny.
Yeah. Yeah, classic Airhead Booster.
Yeah, so Skeets is doing a countdown in the background. It's another event that they know is happening, that Booster is going to save a bunch of people at the nick of time in order to continue to boost his profile. I really do like in these first two pages of this scene how the clutter of all the different text boxes coming from all these different characters does make the scene feel extremely chaotic.
Yeah.
But as Ralph begins to realize that Skeets knows the entire future, you know, Booster keeps saying, you know, he doesn't know everything and that he was a horrible student. They didn't teach a lot of this in school. Ralph just becomes more and more incensed because he asks Booster, hey, we were friends, right? Why didn't you tell me my wife was going to die?
Right. And yeah. Don't use that bad student of history excuse. This was a major pivotal moment for the history of the Justice League. The Justice League disbanded over this. And we were friends. Why didn't you know about this? And like, little shit that he is, Skeets reveals at that moment, oh yeah, I knew the whole time. You just didn't ask me.
What a piece of shit. I would also be furious with this robot if it was mine.
Yeah. I read a piece from Mark Waid where he talked about how this scene was one of the toughest scenes to write in 52 because they were, the four of them over the phone were busting their heads trying to figure out, hey, why wouldn't Booster tell Ralph about Sue Dibny if he has access to all this future knowledge? And it was Greg Rucka who said, just walk right up to it. Have Ralph ask Booster that exact thing. It's the same. He has the same problem.
It's such a good scene, too.
Yeah.
It's very television, right? Like, this feels very Lost inspired, very, you know, Lost especially. There's so many scenes in Lost where, like, one person knows something and the other person has just discovered it. And then they have to have a conversation about, why didn't you tell me?
Yeah.
That's such a TV occurrence.
We do keep talking about how this series is very much inspired by the storytelling structure of Lost, and that feels right out of its playbook.
Yeah, it makes the scene really dynamic. The key in a lot of television shows, television doesn't have an infinite budget, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of things like superhero stuff looks really corny. If you've seen any of the CW DC shows I've mentioned, you'll see some examples of that. And sometimes your suspension of disbelief, it totally works out. But sometimes it does not work out so well. But in order to circumvent that, you need to create extremely good reasons for characters to stop doing superhero stuff and get in a room and talk with each other. And this is an incredibly good reason, and one that I remember fans talking about while Identity Crisis was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, wait a second, he knows Booster Gold, and Booster Gold's in the future. Wait a second.
It feels like writers addressing the concerns of the fandom themselves.
Yeah, but not in a corny way. They didn't, like, make up some magical reason, some, you know, metahuman reason. in a human way. Booster Gold is just self-interested.
Yeah, these characters are flawed. They're not they don't make the perfect choice all the time.
Yeah. So at the very end of the scene, before we transition to the next Renee Montoya appearance, there is an explosion in the distance. The countdown that Skeets was counting down to has, you know, it's finished, and there's an explosion in the distance. And Booster looks at it, so does Ralph, and Ralph tells Booster that he has a chance to prove that he's an actual hero.
Yeah, this is all leading up to this background plot that's been percolating way in the backdrop the past few weeks of Lex Luthor kind of solving the Metahuman Genome Project and figuring out a way to give people superpowers. And Skeets predicts there's going to be some kind of riot at LexCorp that night, and that's where Booster has to be. But there's something else going on that very night in Gotham City.
I love when they make up rich families in Gotham City.
Yeah.
I love that more than anything. They just have to invent someone rich and then draw a big house for them and then be like, this is their entire family history. This is all real. I love that stuff. And this is that in spades. It makes me very happy.
Oh, yeah. Greg Rucka's having a lot of fun here.
Yeah.
He creates this backstory for the Kane family, who for Gotham historians may recognize the name as the maiden name of Bruce Wayne's mother, Martha. So this might be related to that somehow, but that hasn't been established yet. He introduces the Hamilton Rifle Company, which is the fortune that the Canes themselves married into to get even more rich. This is a reference to writer Edmund Hamilton in the Silver Age, for reasons which will soon become apparent.
And I wonder if it's also a reference to the cult fortune.
Oh,
the Colt 45. Yeah, the Colt gun factory
that might be
is in Hartford, Connecticut.
Yeah.
And growing up there, I used to drive past all the time. It's a beautiful building. But there's a piece of this narration that, if you're finished, I'd love to just call attention to, because that's exactly what it reminded me of. The narration here, I'm reading it out loud because it is some extremely fine writing. Like, it's just sentence to sentence, perfect. It takes 3 minutes for permission to approach the house, another 5 to walk up the damn driveway. I try to calculate exactly how much money I pass on my way in and give up at $50 million.
It's so good.
The name is Kane, but the money is Hamilton. Like, trying to calculate the money, you can't begin to count the dead. It's so good!
Oh, man.
You can hear it in your head. She has such a unique voice that is so different from all the other characters in this book.
Yeah.
And it's got a real rhythm to it. You can feel the sort of film noir style patter when you read it. I'm just agog at the skill.
It's such an air to exactly what Denny O'Neill was doing on his own Question series and injecting that into the character that Rucka spent literally years developing over at Gotham Central. I tell people all the time that 52 is as much a sequel to O'Neill's Question as it is Rucka's Gotham Central. You kind of have to read both books to watch them converge in this plot line. And here's where we're really seeing that in Renee.
Yeah, this is like the dream of sharing a universe in a comic book series, right? That you get to write a real successor series to not just your own work, but to something that you would clearly take a huge amount of inspiration from.
Yeah.
And it can be not only just as good, but in some places, like, new and unexpected. That is comic books working at 100%.
The whole idea behind 52 is these writers developing the stories of their favorite characters, not necessarily ones they made, but the ones that mean a lot to them. That's the dream of coming on board one of these long-running shared universes.
Yeah, that's what everyone wants. But unfortunately, it does not always turn out that way.
No, not only does it not always turn out that way, but when it does turn out that way, it often kind of disastrously very much looks like fans of a character writing a character, which...
Yeah. Or even when you do something that is good and well-received.
Yeah.
I know that Jonathan Hickman over at Marvel, a completely different company, I just wanted to mention it, though. I was finally trying to understand what was happening in the X-Men universe. And as much as I love Kieran Gillen, I think he's doing a fine job shepherding the X-Men. But Hickman has made it clear that he had a specific plan for the Krakoa era, the new era of X-Men. But the Krakoa era was so successful that now he can't do it.
Right. They wanted him to stay in Act 1 of this 3-act story he had planned, because why stop a good thing?
Yeah.
But comics are not a medium where you're allowed to develop a character. You have to stay static so you can keep harvesting them for stories for 80 years.
Yeah. It's like Renee really only feels this rich because we get to visit her week to week like a television character. Right.
She's one of the few characters in the DC universe who gets to evolve, at least to a point. Yeah. As long as Rucka was writing her at the anyway. What happens to her after this, we might get into at a future point in time, but I don't want to talk about it right now.
I like to live in the beautiful bubble that is 52 when it comes to Renee.
Renee is the commissioner of the Gotham City Police Department right now in modern Batman comics.
Okay.
It's a choice.
I don't see how this character that we're interacting with right now in 52 could get to there.
Right.
Like, that's how I feel about that particular choice. I just don't see it. At this point where she's really hit rock bottom, there is no path back for her. She's, like, in fact, kind of flipping off the Gotham PD in a lot of ways in this entire series. But especially here in this issue and in the previous time she showed up.
It does feel a little bit like somebody way, 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 way up saying, I know how to reform the police. We'll give them a girl boss.
The other subtitle for this podcast is Gaslight Gatekeeper Boss. What's happening every issue? really thinking about it, in this issue itself, we see Gaslight Gatekeeping and Girl Bossing. So yeah. Speaking of Girl Bossing, as Renee scams her way into this party, there is we do finally get to meet who she confirms as her ex-girlfriend, Kate Kane.
Yeah, Jessica Rabbit walks into this scene. Yeah,
she's dressed exactly like Jessica Rabbit. It's kind of fucked up. I do have this thing, comic book writers or comic book artists, especially ones who are fill-ins that are working in a hurry. So I'll give you some credit there. But up until extremely recently, comic book artists only knew one kind of fancy dress.
Yeah.
And it was either strapless with bustier or one shoulder, like full length gown. Those were the only two dresses.
There's not a lot of overlap between women's fashion design and comic book artists of the 90s and 2000s.
Yeah. It took until the 2010s for someone to be like, oh, wait, let's grab a Vogue or something.
Yeah. Kind of the big reason Joelle Jones's career took off in comics is that she knew how to design a dress.
Yeah, I mean, it does a lot. How much better? The scene is already really good because the character writing is really good. I do watch it and, like, kind of wish that the dress that she is wearing made any sense at all. They're doing a gala in your own home, and she has a strapless bustier, bright red gown. She looks like Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah.
And it's all the way down to the floor with a train and a white shawl. And it's a choice. Yeah,
what's going on with that shawl?
I don't know. It kind of gets forgotten throughout the scene. We do turn the page and the shawl disappears.
It does.
It's completely unnecessary. And it's like, she's wearing, I think, what a guy who's never thought about fashion before thinks of as a fancy dress.
Right.
And that's it. You know, the internet's different now. Now we have access to, you can go to the Vogue website and look at any single runway fashion show that they've ever covered. So I'll give them, you know, and also, again, fill-in issue for this person. And we were not at an era yet where people thought, maybe I should learn how to draw a dress for this comic book. But it would have been even better if she, or even if the Jessica Rabbit reference was, like, really supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Like, that would even be better if she was leaning into it a little bit. Here, it just seems like, well, you drew a pretty lady and you were like, shit, I gotta put clothes on her.
She doesn't even have the temerity to ask, why don't you do right?
She could be saying, I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way.
Right.
And she doesn't do it. Come on.
So what does happen between Renee Montoya and the illustrious Kate Kane in this scene?
God, like any toxic lesbian couple, they immediately flirt with each other and then one of them punches the other in the face.
And what I love about it is that Renee is like, oh, that's a really good punch. Somebody taught her how to throw a punch since we dated 10 years ago.
I love the implication that they have gotten into physical fights before.
Yeah.
She's like impressed at how much she's improved.
Yeah. This is a toxic, abusive relationship that a lot of people ship to this day.
Listen, I love chaos. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But you know, I love Renee and I love Kate. they're not meant to be together. No. And that's kind of what's interesting about them, that they have this continuous falling in and out with each other.
This narration, even more, the dialogue is good. In a text, you described it as a reverse girl walks into a bar scenario.
Yeah, a reverse, and then she walked in.
Yeah, it's like, and then I went to her house.
Because you're coming into her home and ruining her life completely completely uninvited. You crash this party.
That's very funny. Say,
oh, hey, are you still in the closet? Like, what the fuck are you doing here, lady?
Renee is so rude and mean for no reason in this scene. I get it. I do get it. It is like very slap kiss in a good way. The tension works. And tension, like romantic tension, is sometimes pretty hard to portray in comic books. But here, the narration sells it for me. Renee is narrating in the scene. I could always press her buttons, and she could always press mine. That's what made it so good and why it couldn't last. Which is...
That's it, baby.
That's it. That's it in a nutshell. And then the dynamic really, really works between these two. Because, you know, at this time, someone like Kate Kane being in the closet, like dating women but not being out, that was something that people really did. Like, major celebrities really, really did.
Yeah.
This feels like a ripped from the headlines type story. You know, going back to the tabloid cover art that we have, it really feels like this is the kind of story you'd see on the interior of your, you know, dumb tabloid. New York tabloid that you pick up.
Oh, yeah. So the real kind of story meat of this scene is Renee asking Kate to look into this building that her family still owns, the very one where she encountered that monster a few weeks ago and got the cast on her arm and picked up that weird Jack Kirby gun to try to figure out what the hell is going on there, that maybe they have some kind of connection to what happened. And Kate dismisses her, but basically promises she'll look into it.
Yeah, you know, the writing here is perfect. Kate asks her why she should do her a favor, and she just says, Renee says, because once we thought we were in love with each other, and maybe we even were.
Oof.
Just really hits you straight in the heart. We're also back to, it's interesting, we're back to, actually, is it, it's a 9-panel grid on one page. No, it's an 8-panel grid on one page. But then the aspect ratio of those panels squeeze in a little bit. So it's the zooming in effect, but with the opposite sort of panel layout idea, where you can have entire panels now be completely covered with a 3/4 view of a person's face. Mm-hmm. And it feels like you're in a close up in a, you know, a shot reverse shot in a TV show. Yeah. Very soap opera, very melodrama. I could live here. I could live in this issue.
I do live in this series. This is where I live. This is my home.
If you want to find him, you should open up issue 7 of the comic book 52.
Yeah. Like Renee says in this very sequence, you know where to find me. And it's right here in this series. We go back to Metropolis at this point.
Yes. We're back in Booster Gold Town. And Booster very handily does stop this Tinker explosion. But after he does his little feat of heroism and Scoots does this little, Scoots? Did I say Scoots? Why did I do that?
Because
I
know Booster. It's Scoots.
Because
it's Booster and Scoots.
Booster
and Scoots. Booster and Scoots. Booster Yield and Scoots.
So it's very funny. Skeets does like a YouTuber ad right at the end, basically. Yeah. God.
Never leave the house without an official Booster Gold windproof umbrella.
We love that.
Yes. Just use offer code Scoots for 20% off.
I shouldn't be, but if I were writing a Booster Gold series, he would have a podcast and a YouTube channel and a Twitch stream.
Oh, sure.
Obviously. He'd have a GoPro attached to his head.
That actually was the plot of Dan Jurgens recently wrote a 7-issue Blue and Gold series, which is Ted and Booster trying to make money together off this superhero business. And he does have that kind of live stream account that he's trying to like build up social media followers on. It's very much old man trying to talk the kids' language, but the heart's in the right place.
Yeah. No, he was right in that Booster would do that.
Yeah.
Like, Booster would be like Ice Poseidon, basically.
Yeah. It just needed a younger writer. And that's kind of what's happening right now in the Fire and Ice Welcome to Smallville series.
I've heard that series is really good.
Yeah, Joanne Starer It writes a very kind of Paris Hilton, The Simple Life inspired story of Fire and Ice from Justice League International moving into a small town and trying to make something of themselves. And Fire starts up this whole social media thing, and it very much feels like a spiritual sequel to everything that Giffen and DeMatteis were doing in JLI. So if you're looking for that kind of boostery social media superhero content in the DC universe, that is where you find it.
I'm going to pick that up, and next week we'll talk about it to each other as friends. Maybe on air, who knows?
You know I'm always happy to talk about comics. This is when your favorite character shows up, Tim Drake.
My... I can't, you're gonna never gonna let me live that down.
Never.
But Tim would also be out here with the cell phone being like, excuse me.
Yeah.
Because that's the man he is. That's the annoying bisexual that Tim Drake is.
Absolutely.
Tim's hacker name was Doss Boot. I'm gonna slap that nerd.
God damn.
I mean this with all the affection in the world, but Tim Drake, I hate you. I want that twink obliterated.
I do say that about Tim Drake a lot.
Yeah, no, it works. It's Do you think he's really into the new Troye Sivan album? I think he is. Anyway, he's out there doing his stuff, listening to Rush. But
oh, Rush, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
He listens to Rush. He listens to Jonathan Coulton. He owns every They Might Be Giants album.
Oh, that's true. Absolutely he does. He's a big They Might Be Giants guy.
Yeah, that's where I stand on
it. I believe that in my heart. But Lois shows up. My wife, Lois Lane, shows up.
Everybody's wife, Lois Lane.
Yeah, well, specifically Superman's wife, Lois Lane. But my wife, also my wife.
One of my favorite things that develops between Rick Veitch's short-lived Question miniseries and Greg Rucka's Lois Lane series is that both Vic Sage and Renee Montoya have huge crushes on Lois Lane.
That scans.
Yeah.
That scans a lot. She's out there answering the questions.
Exactly. It really entertains me that Vic and Renee have the exact same taste in women.
Pretty lady. What can you say? Yeah. I love that. And she's on her doing her reportery best here. Mm-hmm. She's actually already, before Booster's jig is really up, she is already trying to get Booster Gold to slip up. You can see in the way that she's asking questions, specifically the thing she's asking questions about. We get a little bit of a name drop of the Steel Lex Luthor storyline that hasn't showed up in a couple of weeks. But you can see that she's doing some investigating here. And Booster is deflecting like a well-trained PR agent, like saying, while this sort of superhero pilot program scares me, please don't quote me on that.
Right. because a couple of his sponsors are owned by LexCorp.
Yeah, God, because he's a freaking corporate stooge.
And that's why Lois Lane is in this scene, because she knows what it means for a hero to defend Metropolis. She's taken this personally.
Yeah, and this is her beat, okay? And if you're going to show up on her beat, she's going to know everything about you.
She's like, I used to cover Superman news, and now I have to cover Booster Gold news?
She hates him. The way that her face is drawn, and again, some of these expressions are a little imprecise, but I think that we captured Lois's disdain clearly.
Yeah, absolutely no faults to Ken Lashley there. She is disgusted by Booster.
She hates this man. It's really funny. But even before Booster digs his own grave, someone comes with the shovel to help him out.
Yep.
Manthrax shows up.
Yeah, it's our old buddy Manthrax.
God, and it's like
Bob or maybe Bill Castell. He keeps kind of changing his mind on what his name is.
He's either Robert or William, I'm sure. Yeah. But he's Billiam. How about that?
Yeah, Billiam Castell shows up and claims that Booster's check bounced over the bank in a single bound, so he's here to blow the whistle.
Yeah, I remember reading this particular issue when I was a teenager and being so sad for Booster because I loved him as a character.
Oh, it's devastating.
It's like, it's the worst possible timing and the worst kind of event to have happened to him. Yes, all the cameras are there to expose how you're a fraud.
And what's worse is that he's totally earned this. Everything that is happening is his fault.
And he's been such a dick to all of his friends, right? He could have been open and vulnerable and kind to Ralph, but instead he blew him off And right. now Ralph is not going to defend Booster as a friend that has his heart in the right place. Ralph joins in on this.
Yeah. His old super buddy goes all in on how Booster is a huge disappointment and squarely blames him for letting Blue Beetle, his best friend, die.
That was devastating to read as a Boostle shipper way back in the day. I was like, no, you're hitting him right where it hurts.
Yeah. Like, Booster is literally begging him to stop, and he just keeps digging and digging, and he turns his back and walks away on him, and Booster is now the most hated hero in the universe.
Yeah, he went from being on top of the world, sort of, kind of, to being despised by the people of Metropolis. And they show you a cutaway to show that Ralph Dibny's speech about how much he hates Booster Gold is being broadcast live. So he's exposed, like, he's a PR nightmare. He's, this reference may not make sense by the time you hear this episode, but he is Joe Jonas post-divorcing Sophie Turner. Like, people don't want to have anything to do with this man, starting now.
Yeah. We get one more scene, no words, takes us back to that space planet where Starfire is taking a lap around the planet to clear her head of the no-thinky juice in the apple she keeps eating. And she runs into a giant Jack Kirby dude. It's Devil Lance the Pursuer, who showed up in exactly one issue of Jack Kirby's The Forever People. The kind of pull only Grant Morrison would make of this big intergalactic hunter who worked for Darkseid. Kind of a mini Galactus guy kind of happening here. You see, he's even got those like itty bitty versions of the horns on the sides of his helmet.
It was hard not to refer to him as Galactus when I in my own personal notes. He just, Jack Kirby was not ashamed. No. He was like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it when it came to superhero designs, you know? So you'll see a lot of repeating elements. And it's what made his style so distinctive. But I also think it's like an economy of design.
Yeah.
You know, he knew what kind of helmets looked good. These kinds.
Yeah. So he's brought in this intergalactic hunter into Animal Man, Adam Strange and Starfire's world to basically force them to move this plot, because they were just going to stay here if no one was going to kick them off the planet.
Yeah. Hopefully next week we see them and do anything ever at all.
Yeah.
But I don't think
we'll
so.
We'll see.
We'll see. But that brings us to the end of the issue, right up to the backup.
Yeah, that brings us up to our backup, the history of DCU, everybody's favorite part of 52 at this point.
It's my favorite part of 52. It's not my favorite part of 52. 52 is my favorite part of 52.
Yeah.
But it is
this extremely impossibly truncated version of the entire history of DC Comics that is about to be irrelevant in a year.
It is really fascinating to watch them try to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, try to actually tell the entire story. And that's what's so interesting about these backups. It's not a compelling story. Like, if this was all one thing I read seamlessly, you know, as an experience, I would be like, wow, that was pretty boring.
Yeah.
But it is like a nice little trip down memory lane as you are reading 52.
The last issue of this basically tried to cover everything that happens between 1986 and 1994. And this entire portion of the backup is focused on one event that basically nobody remembers, Zero Hour, which was written by Dan Jurgens, who is also writing History of the DCU. Surprise, surprise. So he spends a lot of time focusing on this and a character by the name of Extant, who is also known as Monarch. The hook behind Extant slash Monarch is that they were allegedly a hero in the modern day who sometime in the next 10 years turns evil and destroys the universe. And the big mystery around the Armageddon 2001 event, which happened in 1991, hence the title, was who becomes Monarch? And the clues that even fandom at the time was very quickly able to pick up on was that Monarch was clearly supposed to be Captain Atom. But editorial got really pissed that everyone guessed early, and they changed his identity to Hawk from Hawk and Dove at the last minute, which makes absolutely no sense in retrospect and is just one of, like, the famous colossal fuck-ups in DC history that people have not been able to untangle.
I don't understand this whole thing. I remember even much later in the future for a project that like had so much more like institutional money behind it. But like Westworld, people got so the people working on Westworld got so mad the subreddit figured it out beforehand.
Yeah.
You should be congratulating yourselves for writing a well-written mystery with really good clues and Mr. X. Like, some people figure it out. I'm sorry, you know, but that means that you've done your job.
Yeah. Brian Michael Bendis actually said something about that I really liked. That, like, if you're doing your job as a mystery writer, you want, like, 15% of people to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want it to be impossible to get, but you don't want everybody to get it.
Yeah, switching it to Hawk of Hawk and Dove at the last minute just made people mad.
Yeah.
Because they were so sure of something, and then they were like, we're doing this specifically to piss you off.
Yeah. So that's basically what's going on in Zero Hour, which is about this fallen hero who teams up with another fallen hero, Parallax, who was Hal Jordan, who went crazy after Mongol destroyed Coast City, to remake the timeline. And it's kind of a soft reboot after 1986's Crisis on Infinite Earths had already rebooted things, to just kind of streamline the timeline and to try to fix whatever was going on with Hawkman, but ultimately made it a lot worse. They killed off some members of the JSA, and we kind of get this little retcon here, where this is the point where Superman from the Golden Age, who, if you'll recall from the Crisis on Infinite Earths recap, got to live in this paradise dimension rather than being erased, starts seeing what's going on there and gets really pissed. And that's going to have consequences down the line.
Yeah. It's interesting to go through like a trip down memory lane with these specific events, because 52 is another sort of aftershock of a giant crisis crossover, you mm-hmm. know? And so now we're getting a little history lesson in all these crisis crossovers, and you can see more clearly how comic book companies use them as a marketing tool. They use them as a tool to organize and streamline all their books. And they also try to use them as genuine narrative tools. But let's be real. Would you ever read Zero Hour by choice?
You're asking the wrong guy.
I mean, fair. You would read everything by choice. Would you read it by choice for a non-trivia reason?
Yeah, you see, I don't know if it's by choice when there is something deeply broken in me that compels me to read all this stuff. I don't think That's have a choice.
That's fair. You are just deeply compelled to know everything about the DC universe. But if I tried to read Zero Hour, I literally did. So I was curious, like, how is the story constructed? It is not compelling.
There's a line in Alex Paknadel's Night Terrors tie-in where Barry Allen is talking to Hal Jordan, and Hal tells Barry that love is the opposite of choice, which is very much that kind of like, what is grief if not love persevering, of just like comparing a noun to a noun so it sounds profound. But like, that's how I feel about DC Comics. I don't have a choice because I love it so much.
You know, I feel that. I do understand that. I have read so many bad comic books because there was one character I liked in them.
That's it, baby. Yeah.
You know?
Step one of fandom is following characters. Step two of fandom is following creators.
Yeah. I got as far as Grant Morrison, and that was a little too much.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the classic blunders. You started a land war in Asia.
That is exactly the equivalent. No, those are equivalent activities to do. If you're going to start reading comics, I definitely think Animal Man and their JLA run and DC 1 Million are great books.
Yes.
But maybe find another comic book writer to sort of go back and forth between.
Give yourself a Mark Waid. Give yourself a Greg Rucka.
Yeah, yeah. Someone who has a mature adult take on the medium, because, you know, it's great that children read comic books, but hopefully you're not a child if you're listening to this. But
we swear a whole lot.
Yeah, we've sworn a whole lot on this episode.
Yeah.
But Rucka and Waid, they give you that good comic stuff without making you feel like you are eating like sugary cereal, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, this entire issue is a pitch for you, the listener, to go read Gotham Central.
Absolutely.
The Greg Rucka parts. Just do it. You will not have a bad time.
What's your favorite scene in this issue? I mean, I know, but I have to ask because of the format of our program.
I mean, as much as I love Lois, my favorite scene is definitely every single moment of Kate and Renee talking to each other.
The kiss slap.
Oh my God. It is what I love about melodrama is stuff like that. Two ex-lovers that have to reluctantly help each other. I love that stuff.
It's great. It's delicious drama. It's an excellent way to set up Kate Kane, who we're meeting here for the first time and is about to become a major player in DC Comics.
Yeah, this character really did, I would say, I don't think it is wrong to say that this character changed a lot of people's lives.
Yeah.
Like, it is one of the examples of corporate diversity that actually really did work out. And I think DC, while I'm not sure that all of their extra material adaptations of Kate Kane's character have gone super good, I'm glad that they were able to make her a flagship character.
Absolutely. We're going to see a lot more of that going forward. And, yeah. You know, the beginning of 52 kind of teased us that the question would be the heir to Batman. But really, it's kind of a vehicle to set up what's coming afterwards. It's not going to be much longer before Kate Kane literally inherits the mantle of Detective Comics for a while. Like, mm-hmm. The story is going to be about her. Yeah, that's kind of the most exciting era for the character.
Yeah.
And we see it all start here in this issue where she looks like Jessica Rabbit.
What was your favorite scene from this issue?
Oh, it's absolutely that Ralph Dibny Booster Gold confrontation. No question at all.
Oh, it's really good. It's another really like what you want out of a melodrama story, right?
Yeah. That's,
these are the peaks of the drama. It's perfect.
It's absolutely on point. This is exactly where these characters are at these points in both of their lives and exactly what they need to be hearing from and telling each other. And it's what we need to advance both stories. It's perfect storytelling that emphasizes the fact that these aren't all plot lines happening next to each other in isolation. This isn't an anthology. It is a series where these stories can genuinely affect one another. And that's what separates it from, like, Action Comics back in the 1930s when it was just, like, 11 different stories in one collection. It's not these four writers telling their own things. There are meaningful ways they interact. That's the promise of 52 delivered.
Yeah. And in this case also, it's delivering an interaction that fans have longed to see and keeping these characters perfectly in character or during that interaction while also like resolving like dumb fandom hair splitting, I would call it. You know, why didn't Booster, you know, but why didn't Booster tell him about Sue? It's because Booster Gold is a self-involved person.
Like, I hope someone got fired for that blunder.
David, my husband now, David. David loves saying that about everything and everything. Anytime like our like surround sound speaker is not working, he's like, I hope someone got fired for that blunder. But it's great.
God.
The Simpsons is also good.
Yeah.
That's what I'll say.
Simpsons is also good, to a point.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate what happened there. But, I mean, we wouldn't be doing this podcast if we were not also invested in a long-running institution that has periods of extreme badness.
That's true. That's very true.
So, Alex, what are you going to put on the blackboard for this issue?
I got a couple things I want to put on the blackboard. One smaller, one bigger. The smaller one is during that first Renee Montoya scene, we see a newspaper on our kitchen counter that says Catwoman robs pharmacy in quotation marks. This is one of the few overtures that 52 is doing to a 1 year later storyline, kind of acknowledging that 1 year later exists. Because in Catwoman, we see that Selina Kyle got pregnant and had a baby. And we see this flashback scene where she breaks into a pharmacy and steals a pregnancy test, but leaves money for it on the counter, hence the quotation mark. So that's what's going on in this scene. But I really want to talk about the Kane family, Kate Kane, or specifically Kathy Kane. Now, let me take you back to the 1950s. This was the age of Seduction of the Innocent and Frederick Wortham and the Comics Code Authority saying there were all these evil messages coded in Batman that it was teaching kids to be gay. So they needed to take all of the gayness out of Batman and all of the deviant sexual behavior. So first of all, they had to remove Catwoman, who is all this like straight up BDSM character in Batman comic. We can't have her around anymore. She literally disappeared from comics for 12 years. Just right in the middle of Batman history. People don't talk about it a lot.
That's so sad.
And they were like, well, Batman needs a love interest. He needs a woman in his life so that people can say, see, he's got a girlfriend. And that's where Kathy Kane shows up. She's a yellow suited Batwoman who, instead of a utility belt, she has a red handbag. And she's always coming on to Batman, and Batman is always rebuffing her, which doesn't make him look any less straight, any more straight, I should say. It's a real misunderstanding of kind of the mission statement here. But nevertheless, the legacy of Batwoman is that she was specifically introduced into Batman comics as a case of the not gays. So when it came time to reinvent Batwoman, Greg Rucka thought to himself, hey, wouldn't it be great if when we bring Batwoman back, she's an explicitly gay character, just to turn that entire era on its head.
It's perfect.
And that's exactly the thought where this whole Kate Kane reinvention comes from.
It's a perfect salute and middle finger to that era, I think. You know? And the fact that she's still in the closet, I think, is also perfect for that. What else was the Seduction of the Innocent era symbolizing other than a call to gay people to remain in the closet? Well, here,
exactly,
she's not quite out, but she does know she's a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty cool, honestly. A pretty cool way of dealing with this sordid history. Speaking of sordid history and gay things, I know what I wanted to put on the blackboard for me, and it's Boostle. It's Booster Gold and Blue Beetle shipping.
Sure.
Because there's that line in that scene where Ralph is really taking Booster Gold to task. And he is saying, you know, you're the reason why your best friend Blue Beetle died. I really got into Booster Gold through reading Blue and Gold fanfic. I really, really, really did. I was a Ted Kord fan initially. Got so upset when he died. Drowned my sorrows in like fix-it fic of the two of them hanging out and being in love with each other. Yeah. Shipping is not necessarily a theory, right? Shipping is something where people are used to not seeing the queerness of the characters that they believe they see actually being actualized in a plot and taking matters into their own hands and being like, I'm imagining a universe where these two characters are gay and in love with each other. People shipped Booster and Blue Beetle for a very, very long time, mostly because of that Justice League International run, even though Ted and Booster had women troubles in there, they are always just hanging out and doing pranks with each other. They're guys being dudes, but in a distinctly homoerotic way.
I mean, I didn't get that vibe when I was reading it until someone pointed out to me that Booster is the kind of person who would bet Blue Beetle that he couldn't fit his entire dick in his mouth, and then he'd be like, I'll take that bet.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
He's a himbo that doesn't understand that having gay sex is gay. Like, that's
right.
That's
yes, exactly.
The kind of man he
that,
is.
That is their relationship. They don't understand.
Exactly. He's like, me, gay? No, I just like having sex with Ted. Anyway.
Watchtower duty is boring. What else are we going to do?
If we're not jerking each other off, I'm going to take a nap. God. You see how easy it is?
Yeah.
This is how you get into this rabbit hole. And just that moment to me and my little shipper 16-year-old brain, to me, that was like a confirmation of canon for me. The only thing that you could say to Booster Gold in that moment that would make him feel like actually internalize that he's done wrong is that he was responsible for his best friend's death.
Right.
His best, like, that is the only positive personal relationship that he has with a dead man.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is the stuff that fanfic dreams are made of. Like, mm-hmm. It all makes sense when you understand. And ever since 52, the relationship, the deep personal friendship between Blue Beetle and Booster Gold really has been canonized as the most significant platonic friendship, at least in Booster Gold's life.
Yeah, I'm going to say some of my favorite semi-canon Boostle content, if you haven't checked it out, is in Tom Taylor's Injustice 2 tie-in comics.
Oh my God, really?
Where Booster Gold is very much kind of looking after Jaime because that's his only way of still being connected to Ted.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's this just like tragically beautiful storyline in the middle of this video game tie-in that I think you should check out.
I absolutely will. I have a kind of a soft spot for Injustice just because everything that NetherRealm does, like the gratuitous violence is just itchy and scratchy to me. I think it's so funny.
I maintain to this day that one of the funniest things to ever happen in a comic book is when Dick Grayson just dies because he fell on a rock the wrong way. People it's got so best. Mad about that.
No, that's perfect. That's what a comic book is. I'm sorry. And it would happen to Dick also. Yeah. Like, that's something that would occur.
Yeah, Damien hit him on the head with an Escrava stick. He fell over and crack. And Damien's like, I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah, no, that works. That works for me. That's actually, if that is not how Nightwing eventually dies canonically, I'm going to be so mad.
Oh, man. I want to talk about dumb death scenes. Tom King's Batman reveals us that the actual canonical death that Bruce Wayne goes through is that he got cancer from fighting Dr. Phosphorus once, who's like a D-list Batman villain.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
God, speaking of extra material Batman stuff, my favorite death scene from the Dark Knight Rises with the Fire Rises.
The Fire Rises, Mr. Wayne.
That's something that David and I also do around the apartment, is just say Bane quotes. And like, oh, what a beautiful voice.
The streets will run with Razzie Zazzy.
Speak of the devil. That's my favorite one. Speak of the devil. I love when Marion Cotillard, playing the worst Talia al Ghul of all time, just kind of like takes a nap in the middle of her speech, and like we're supposed to believe that's her death.
Like a red versus blue-esque herg bleh.
Bleh. That's exactly what she sounds like, and her head just nods forward, and you're like, I guess she's dead.
I'm dead. Like in Shakespeare when someone goes, and now I die.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Like, there's some things that Christopher Nolan is good at, and there's some things that he's not good at. Nah. I'll say being very generous.
Okay. Oh, boy. Yeah, well, that's the issue. I think it's time for us to go to the mailbag. It's Ask the Question. If you want to ask us a question, just write in your questions to 52mailbag@gmail.com, and we'll probably get around to them. I mean, if we don't get mad at us, okay? But we're doing our best. But the more time I have to give to the mailbag, the less time I have to ask Gita the things I want to ask them. So please understand my plight here. Our first question comes from Matt Miller, who says, setting aside all considerations of a character's future commercial viability, which superhero being revealed as the Monarch would have been the most satisfying resolution to the Armageddon 2001 mystery? Gita, did you read Armageddon 2001?
I did not read Armageddon 2001.
That's fine. Because here's what I'm going to say about Armageddon 2001. Back in 1990 to 1991, DC had a major choice whether to promote one of two crossovers happening at the time as their major event. There was Armageddon 2001, which was this big story revolving around this mysterious Monarch villain. But there was also War of the Gods, which was happening in Wonder Woman at the time, which is about all the deity pantheons fighting each other because they were being manipulated by Cersei into just kind of upending the cosmic world. And it was kind of the culmination of everything that George Perez had been building in Wonder Woman since 1986. And they chose wrong! Armageddon 2001, not just in the basis of who the ultimate villain is, but just kind of the entire direction of it was a little misguided as an event. And there's a reason we don't really talk about it anymore, other than the presence of Wave Rider, who is this kind of like gold suited time traveling dude who shows up a few times in 52. So we'll probably talk about him a little more then. But yeah, the Monarch was designed to be Captain Atom. It should have been Captain Atom. Case closed.
I'm with you on that. That all is right. True. We already talked about it, but it's just true. It just should have been Captain Atom. It doesn't make sense if it's not Captain Atom. There's a couple of comic book. Do you ever like watch a movie or read a book or anything, read a comic book where you're like, I'm just going to politely pretend that the thing that's happening in my head is canon and just ignore every reference to it?
All the time.
Yeah.
Literally every time someone says that Zeus is Wonder Woman's dad, I let it just pass through my head.
The comics are great because you know also someday someone who has the same opinion as you is going to get the helm of that comic and they're going to make it be happening. Your canon, your headcanon does actually have the chance to become canon.
Exactly. That's the magic of comics. Our next question comes from Bo Q, who asks, which Robin has the best haircut?
Oh my God, that's a hard one.
If you could do a quick vibes only ranking of Robin haircuts from best to least best, I would enjoy that. Thanks in advance.
For me, the big problem is Red Hood's hair good or bad? Jason, does he have good or bad hair? I don't know.
I mean, I think we can all agree the best hair is Stephanie Brown.
Yes. No, obviously that's number one.
Yeah. That big poof she had in the back during the 6 months she was Robin, it was great.
I loved it. She was giving Amy Winehouse. It was really working for me. She has, I think, one of the best Robin costumes, like, just by far. It should be a Halloween costume every year.
Absolutely.
Jason Todd wins for having the most amount of hair things you can do. He has, it's standing up, right? It's got white streaks. He's the only redhead. There's a lot of things happening here. I don't know if it all works out.
I'm going to have to say Jason Todd is not a redhead. That's a Grant Morrison thing. Jason Todd fans disown that.
Okay, fair.
The whole hair dye thing is, I'm going to say that's not canon. Stricken from the record.
He gets an auburn tone to his black hair, though, sometimes.
All right. The deal is, it was part of Grant Morrison's whole every story is canon thing, because Jason Todd has this weird distinction that he has two different origin stories before Crisis on Infinite Earths and after Crisis on Infinite Earths. And before Crisis on Infinite Earths, he was a redhead who dyed his hair. And after Crisis on Infinite Earths, he just had black hair. And Grant Morrison, like, oh, he's been dying it this whole time, but literally nobody else is held by that because it kind of doesn't really make sense to the whole resurrection storyline. So it's a thing that the Jason fandom has largely discarded.
Jason Gurley's Please Don't Come For Me. I wasn't thinking of him as a ginger. I was thinking of him as like an auburn haired. You do see sometimes it looks like he's putting a red glaze over black hair is what it looks like. I am not a ginger Jason truther. No. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, all of the Robins basically have the same hair. The idea is that Bruce keeps adopting the same boy over and over again, and that's the point.
Which is the same boy that is him.
Yeah.
Also upsetting.
Yeah, he keeps adopting young him so that he can have a dad the way he didn't. And Alfred's in the corner just like, I'm not going to take that personally.
So I will say I've always liked the way that Damien's had his hair styled. And I do like Tim Drake's little, like, he still has hair like a millennial, like, middle schooler in 2006. And I do like that. That feels very in character. He's the millennial Robin to me.
Yes.
Tim Drake.
Yeah. So, ranking from best to worst. Number one, Stephanie Brown. Number two?
I'm going to go Tim.
Okay.
I think he just works for the character. I don't know if it's the best hair, but I like his whole character design a lot.
All right. Then let's say three, Damien. Four, Jason, and I guess five, Dick, because Dick just has default haircut.
Yeah, he just has snap-on level hair, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how we rank our Robin hair.
Thank you for that really, really great question.
Yeah, thank you. Please, more questions like that and less questions. You know what? We'll take all kinds of questions.
I love listening to Alex nerd out. So if you want to ask extremely nerdy questions, please go ahead and do it.
Yeah. We're not going to restrict the kind of questions you want to ask. Just go ahead and get as weird or as stupid as possible.
All right. Is that the end of this issue? This issue of this podcast? Podcasts don't have issues.
It might be. There's one more thing. I had one thing I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind. Please.
Oh, okay. Let me know.
That thing is, are you ready?
Oh, shit. I'm not ready, actually. Fuck. God damn it.
Wahoo!
Two Pickup is an Aftermath production created by Gita Jackson and Alex Jaffe and edited by Esper Quim with original music by John Ahrens. The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the show's personalities and do not reflect those of DC Entertainment or Warner Brothers. Please rate and review our show wherever you can and send your questions and comments to 52mailbag@gmail.com. Never stop reading comics.